Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here because I'm in London, and me, Samuel Mann. And tonight's guest is David Bent, who is the Director of Sustainable Business at the Forum for Future in London. He's also the Policy Fellow in the Centre for Science and Policy at Cambridge University. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for the chance to speak.
So let's go for that big question then, because at Cambridge you're looking at what is the role of business in transition to a global sustainable economy. Just a small question then.
Just a tiny question. So I think that question has come out of the last 11 years I've been working at Forum on different things across that time, which we're trying to make and accelerate the change to a sustainable world. And before that, I was an accountant at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and before that, I was a physicist and did physics at Oxford. And I suppose, whatever it is now, 15, 20 years into my career, it was the right moment to ask the big questions. And the big question being, after working with business for 10 plus years on becoming more sustainable, there seemed to be the right time to ask, what's the role of business? And what I'm finding, I think, is that there's a technical side, there's a change management side, there's a what technologies are going to work side, there's all of that normal strategy stuff, innovation stuff, which we do a lot of here at Forum, but there's also a political economy dimension. So not just the economics, but the interaction between the economics and the politics, which is pulling me a little bit out of my comfort zone, I have to confess, but I think it's reinforcing to me how important a political narrative is, and thinking of businesses as political actors as well as economic actors. So I'm only halfway into my first year of that, and it's already very interesting, and it's already flowing back into the work I do here as Director of Sustainable Business at Forum.
So let's just cover off your background, shall we? So where'd you grow up?
So I was born in Halifax, or I should say Alifax, in West Yorkshire, in the north of England. We moved down to Kent when I was about 8, which is why I lost my accent. Some people might be able to hear some short A's. I say Castle and Bath rather than Castle and Bath. Something my children always pick me up on when I say it's time for a bath. They say, no, it's Daddy, it's time for a bar.
That's telling you.
That's telling me. And then I went to Oxford to do physics.
Why physics?
Why physics? So this is a piece of continuity, actually, because I was always interested in how does the world work, how can we better understand what's going on, and I suppose temperamentally I'm attracted to the analytical side and actually creative side of physics. People think of it as very, very dry, but actually the best physicists are very creative people. So I did physics for 4 years at Oxford, and in that time I realised that I didn't have enough mathematical talent to do very much research that would add much beyond decimal points to the world of physics. But what was a very active, this is the mid-90s, in Oxford at the time, was what we now call sustainability, but back then was called development, environment, a whole cluster of issues. And I was involved in the very first ever alternative careers fair in 1996 in Oxford. Some of my friends organised a debate between Shell and Nigerian ambassador on one side, and the Ogoni people represented by, I think, Kenta Arriva's son on the other. So it was all around the time of Brent Spar, the Nigeria stuff, and the Ogonis. All of that was kicking off, and what was for a time called CSR was all making its way forward in the world. I then had what you might call an alternative career fail, in that I went from being a physicist to qualifying as an accountant at PricewaterhouseCoopers. And the reason for that was that, unlike many of my fellow students, I didn't feel like I could rely on my parents to have a big gap year and just disappear off and go to New Zealand or Australia or wherever else it might be. And I felt like I needed a good professional grounding in order to do whatever was next. So,
and your maths wasn't good enough, so you went to be an accountant.
Well,
it was good enough to be an accountant.
Accounting maths is adding up and subtracting. Physics maths is a little bit more tricky. So I said to my friends who were making their way into what we now call sustainability that I wasn't selling my soul, I was just mortgaging it. And in that period, after 2 years of doing exams, you have to do 3 years of experience. So I finished my exams, was bored to hell, and part of which is that auditing in particular, it shouldn't matter who audits you, they should always come up with more or less the same answer. And so accounting and auditing requires a certain amount of conformity, which just doesn't work for me. And I found this course called Responsibility and Business Practice, which is at the University of Bath, an Action Research Master's run out of the School of Management there, that really spoke to me somehow. So I did that part-time for 2 years whilst working at PwC, and that was a very, very rich experience. And during the course of that Master's, every other person changed their job, apart from me, until the last minute when I got I got the same email from six people who came across a job called Green Accountant here at Forum.
Mm-hmm.
So my network worked and they all pointed it straight at me. This is the job for you. And I applied for it and got it. I literally handed in my dissertation, went on holiday, and then started my new job at Forum, which at that time was just green accounting. How could we put a value on the impact, often negative, that a company has, to help them make better decisions so that they are more environmentally resilient, I guess, or more environmentally aware. And that became sustainability accounting, including social externalities as well as environmental externalities. And the interesting thing, so I did that for about 4 years, 3 or 4 years. And the interesting thing about that was that the more that we found better ways of putting a cost on how much effort it would take a company to move from its current position to being sustainable, the less likely they were to use that information. Because you're basically telling them off. So one thing is you're telling them off, bad boys, naughty, naughty, you shouldn't be doing this. The other thing, you're making the opposite of a business case. You're saying that it was costly to do this. And that's because we were valuing the externalities in terms of what's called a shadow cost. How much it would cost them to avoid causing any damage. And so we stopped trying to push that boulder up.
So in essence, so you found that the more detail you got of the environmental cost, the less likely they were to address it.
In many ways, yes, but in that, because we were framing it all wrong, we were saying, and this I think is one of the big transitions I've seen across the 10 years I've been at Forum, we were starting off with very much a responsibility mindset of business has an impact on the world, often a negative impact. What can we do to make that impact less?
Mm-hmm.
And if you start with that mindset, then you come up with all sorts of compliance and regulations and things. And that, most business people don't find that very inspiring. They give it to somebody to just sort of make this problem go away.
Yeah.
Make sure we comply, or we'll go off and make money somewhere else. And so it's not a very strong narrative in terms of creating change. And what we found, what the shift I've seen over the 10 years, and it's exemplified by us leaving behind this shadow cost approach, was businesses began to realise that the world has an impact on them. And it's not enough to just talk about, because the world has an impact on business, you then need to ask the question, how can we as a business be successful in a world that is being affected by sustainability? So what the green accounting and sustainability accounting really focused on was the cost to the business of becoming more sustainable. And that exemplified what I now think of as a responsibility mindset, where you start off by saying the business has an impact on the world. How can we make that impact less bad? And the switch I've seen over the last 10 years is to now say the world has an impact on the business. what can the business do to be successful in a world dominated by sustainability? And that opens up a whole new terrain of things you can do, including looking at the opportunities and including framing things as strategic risks, which if you do nothing about, then your entire industry is at risk, rather than something you can just comply with and sort of put away in the corner. So we left the accounting work behind, and instead my role became head of business strategies. And that was what we tried to do there, was to use Forum's competence in futures, so trends, factors, scenarios, weak signals, to then influence what the sustainability strategy, but also the business strategy is. So what should your business strategy be so that you are successful in a world dominated by climate change, population growth, development, and so on, all of those big issues and factors that we sort of bundle together into sustainability. And so that head of business strategy's role was one where we used scenario planning with PepsiCo, with trends and factors with people like Balfour Beatty and O2, which is Telefonica's mobile network here in the UK, and so on. I can't remember how many, something like 10 or 15 sustainability visions written in my time, COVID helped to be written. That my role in Forum has sort of grown as Forum's own approach to change has grown. So whilst I was head of business strategies, the big focus was on how can we create change by helping leading businesses go further, faster? And those leading businesses were, fortunate for us, part of the leading companies in the world. So the Marks & Spencers, Unilever, both Plan A and the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, we were one of the midwives to both of those. Both of them had many midwives, but we were involved in giving birth to them. And amongst others as well. And about 5 years ago, those leading companies were saying to us, well, we're trying our hardest, the change agents within them, but there's a limit to what an individual company can do in terms of creating change. And that limit is set by the system that they're in, legal, regulatory, also the standard practices and the way that other competitors are operating. And we took a long, hard look at ourselves because we were also disappointed with the pace and scale of change.
Mm-hmm.
And about 4 years ago, we started with a new approach for us, or at least something which turned up the volume on one part of what we're doing, which we call our system innovation approach. So that's deliberately trying to align all of our work to create change at a system level. And sometimes that's one-on-one with individual companies trying to help them create change at a system level. And that might be through their straightforward business strategy. It might be through products and services they innovate. It might be through the collaborations they set up. And we've also been setting up specific collaborations within especially food and energy as systems that if we don't get the food system globally and the energy system globally right, then we don't really stand a chance. And so my role has transitioned into leading all of Forum's work with business globally,
mm-hmm.
especially on that one-to-one advisory side. How can we help individual companies play their part in the transition to a global sustainable economy? And that's where the question that I'm pursuing as a policy fellow comes in, because I'm interested in what the other perspectives are in what needs to be done for that. The Forum has a theory of change, which we're trying to put into practice. I have a theory of change as well, but it's time to learn about some more. So the journey there is, one, the key thing is the move away from, which I hope that Forum has had something to do with, a move away from framing things in terms of responsibility, which rather traps you in ethics and duty, and you have to hope that people share your value set, to a frame which is based on sustainability. How will you be successful in the long term? And even if you're a rabid Milton Friedman business of business is business, even if you're at that end of the scale, if you want your business to be successful, you have to pay attention to these issues. And so that transition is the big one, and the shift in how we've been trying to create change speaks to that transition.
So let's do Forum for the Future 101.
Yeah. So, Forum for the Future, we're a mission-driven, independent non-profit, and we exist to We work globally with business, government and others to solve complex sustainability challenges. We've been going, I think it's 17 years now, and I've been here for 11. And across that time, we've tried to fulfil our mission in different kinds of ways. As I say, right from and now, our where we're trying to fulfil our mission is through system innovation, and that expresses itself in some different parts. So one is the work I lead, which is with business, usually one-on-one, but not exclusively, making individual businesses go further on their sustainability journey, so they're creating system change. The other part is we have a focus on the food and energy systems. We have our food and energy teams. Each team is pursuing change in those systems in slightly different ways because those systems need different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of energy, particularly here in the UK, the energy system is very stuck. We have a small number of large players who say that change can't happen. And so we're trying to be disruptive there. And we're running, we initiated and are sort of the secretariat to a community energy coalition, which is trying to show that you can have energy owned locally, made by renewable sources, especially wind and solar, where local communities take more control of their energy supply. And we're sort of the key fulcrum in a coalition across many different actors there. In the food side, food companies are a bit more exposed. They can see that their supply chains are more exposed. And so our work in food has been more in picking off food commodities and helping that value chain, value network, to understand how are they going to be more successful in a future dominated by sustainability, and most recently working with the tea industry. So we use scenarios to understand what might the tea industry look like in 2030, therefore what would be a sustainable vision, therefore what should the tea industry be doing now in order to drive change towards sustainable tea. And that's given rise to a number of different what we call innovation platforms, where different parts of the tea industry are trying to work on different aspects of delivering that vision. So business one-on-one, food, energy, and then we also have what we call our system innovation lab, where we are trying to experiment with the cutting edge of creating change at a system level. This has many, many different aspects to it, as any lab should. And we are increasingly focusing on, within the lab, how can you scale up what seems to be working, what we found and what the Shell Foundation has come to us about a year ago and said is, we Shell Foundation, like a lot of development agencies, like a lot of philanthropic trusts, and like a lot of businesses and governments as well, we've got pilots which seem to work, but then those pilots never seem to go anywhere. What can we be doing in order to, we the initiator of those pilots, to scale those up so that there is system level change? And over the last year we've been looking at, well, how do you scale up impact? Coming out of that, we've got a sort of framework, and we're also, we have part funding, we're looking for match funding on setting up a scaling up living laboratory where somebody could bring to us a pilot, somebody could bring to us some sort of pioneering practice which is working on a small level, but it's now a question of, instead of it being three villages or eight, whatever it might be, so that it becomes tens of thousands. And then the final, so I warned you that the forum has many component parts, and the final part is, there's so many parts that I've missed off one element which has been implied so far, which is our futures capability. So we have a future centre which is part funded by the Singaporean Development Board, and is part located in Singapore, where we have people looking at what are the big trends in the world and also what are the things which are emerging, little weak signals of what the future might be, that we can then use in our work in food, energy and business. And so then the final part is our network. So we have about 120, 130 companies and other organisations who are members and partners in one way or another. And that gives us a set of relationships which we can, firstly, we gather insight about what the hell's going on in the world. And secondly, we can then build, or it's almost like when you make a crystal, you need a little starting point. You need, so often our collaborations come out of one of our partners saying to us, I have this problem which I can't solve alone. And then we can start to build using our other relationships, a coalition, a collaboration which tries to do something about that. So I realise that's lots of different stuff. Underneath it is an ethos of partnership. So our founders, Jonathan Porritt, Sarah Parkin, and Paul Lukens, and some of your listeners in Otago may know the Porritt name because Jonathan's father, I think, was the last, what do they call it? Not Director General, but one of the last governors of New Zealand. So people may live on Porritt Street. The three founders had a long time in campaigning, and post Rio 92, they could see that campaigning, throwing mud, was not really enough. People were beginning to say, "Okay, we get it. It's important. Now what should we do?" And so Forum was founded on the notion of partnership and long term working. Now partnership is something which, so back in the mid 90s, that was a relatively novel idea, that you have a civil society entity that was filled with campaigners, former campaigners, and that you'd work in collaboration with these nasty businesses. Now partnership is de rigueur, it's everywhere that's doing it. But we would say that we've been doing it longer, and many of the relationships we have are 10 years old plus. So Unilever, M&S, these people, we've been working with them for a very long time.
Some of what you're saying, though, would be things that they don't want to hear. Because it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
So how do you convince them to pay for that?
Well, they partly, so this partly comes back to always reiterating that we are independent and mission driven, and we're a charity in UK law. And so one of the primary things we provide, in a way, is being a critical friend. We're not a consultancy which will take your watch and tell you the time. We're a mission-driven organisation which, if we don't agree with what you're doing, we'll tell you. We'll tell you behind closed doors, unlike Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, climb your building and daub you with paint to tell you. But we'll tell you behind closed doors. And so part of what the change agents in those companies are looking for is somebody who can bring the difficult truths, the inconvenient truths, to coin a phrase, into the conversation. Now, that does lead to many sort of balances. What's the most that this organisation at this moment can handle, with a view to them in a year's time being able to handle more? So there's always those sorts of boundary, or sort of that's not boundary, but balancing acts to be done. And also, I think it's fair to say we struggle to get funding for some of the things we want to do, particularly on the more disruptive side. Because with the best will in the world, even with the pioneering organisations we're working with, they are, to some extent, dependent on the status quo. We're trying to change the status quo, and creating that sort of disruption, it's in the interest of people who don't yet exist in the form of future generations, and it's very difficult for future generations to pay current wages.
Does it matter who the change agent is in the business you're working with?
It does, and that's why we have our corporate engagement guidelines. So we have some rules about who we work with, one of which is that we have access to board-level executives on an annual basis. So sometimes the change agent is the chief sustainability officer. Sometimes it's the chief executive, but we always need to have that board level access, because if our contact can't get that board level access, then there's really little chance of them being able to create the sort of change that we're talking about.
So if somebody's the sustainability compliance officer, without support from above, and it's sort of just a thing, then they're going to push to make any changes.
And I know people who work in that role, and I feel for people who work in that role where they want it to be more than just compliance, but they just can't get the traction. We're only about 70 people, so I listed about how many different things there are. We're 70 people, and we're based in New York, London, Mumbai, and Singapore. We only have so much we can do, and therefore we have to concentrate our time and attention activities on those parts where we think we're creating most change.
Of the people that are working with you, have they come through similarly interestingly diverse routes as you have, or are they people that set out wanting to do sustainability and?
Well, I think that I think the profession of sustainability, if you like, is changing. So there are, I think there are people now. I get emails from them, people ask for internships here at Forum, who they're just leaving university or sort of in their early 20s, and they want to start with sustainability. And they perhaps have done a master's, which is a specialist master's straight out of university, so they're a master's in sustainability and energy or something like that. Or there's a very famous imperial master's in environmental technology, where people just go, some of them just go straight into it. And they're going to have their entire career in sustainability, and not all of sustainability, but some sort of fragment of it, if you like. For people like myself, and maybe like you, who've been in the field for 10, 15 years, we probably started off doing something else first, and we probably think that you can try to cover the whole field, like and certainly someone, so one of our founders, Jonathan Porritt, is astounding in that, because he's been in the field for so long, he knows a little bit about almost everything that is in sustainability. I think of it a bit like a balloon, which gets bigger over time, and the earlier you are involved, the more of the balloon you can cover. And what, so I realise this metaphor may not work for everyone, but anyway, as it gets bigger, the extent you can understand of the whole gets smaller. And this sort of fragmentation, specialisation, it's what happens in fields. It's why Renaissance men could contribute on mathematics and theatre, and why we now have professors of mathematics and professors of theatre who don't even speak to each other. And so one of the things that I think is happening in sustainability in general is it's getting bigger. In order to make a contribution on a particular topic, you need to be a specialist much more. And it means that having a diverse background actually might get in the way of making contributions at a specialist level. At the same time, I have a perspective, the Forum has a perspective, that sustainability is not a collection of individual things, but it's actually a relationship between all of those different things. And having a connected sense of how they all fit together is important, but it's one of the things we're finding, and I think we'll find this more and more, is that being valued for making connections is actually a very difficult thing for people to see. It's sort of invisible. And because it's much easier to respect experts in solar power rather than somebody who goes, well, how does that solar power relate to, relate to deforestation because of palm oil? We have, for instance, I'll give you a for instance. Right now we're working with a company who is exploring using synthetic biology to improve its cleaning products so that it needs to have less palm oil used. So what's happening is that some of the green campaigners are saying synthetic biology sounds like genetically modified organisms. We hate genetically modified organisms, therefore we hate synthetic biology, therefore stop. And they're not seeing the whole picture of, well, if this new technology, if you can control the risks on this new technology on the one hand, and on the other hand you massively reduce deforestation in order to grow more palm oil, isn't that a good thing? But to see those connections and to see the dynamics and to be able to play out and see what the unintended consequences might be requires seeing the connected whole. But as sustainability gets bigger, more and more of the actors in it are going to be specialists. And therefore, your original question a little while ago was about do people have this diverse background? I think people who've been in the field for 10, 20 years probably have a diverse background, but the people joining now in their early 20s will have an increasingly specialised background, and people are becoming much more specialised.
So we're probably going to have to work quite hard to maintain that transdisciplinary systems view.
Yes. And particularly because, as I say, it's much easier to see the value that comes from an expert than the value of somebody who comes from a connector. The connection value sort of gets missed out or disappeared, a bit like the relationship holding stuff. And so people don't pay for that, physically. So we're going to have to work hard and work hard on why it's not good enough to just be fragmented, and why we don't want to repeat the dynamic and repeat the failures of the current mode of market-based capitalism, what we have, which is that fragmentation, specialization, getting ever more efficient in each part without asking, is ever greater efficiency driving a more effective and a better world overall? It's possible for each part to be doing brilliantly, but for the whole to be doing badly. And we have to find ways of framing that so it doesn't take 20 minutes to explain.
And doing it in a way that doesn't scare the horses.
Yes. So you were asking earlier about working with companies, do they want to do all the things that we'd like them to do, and how do we get paid for it? So there's one aspect, which is about the change in the status quo. Another aspect is to do with agency. If people don't feel like they can make a contribution, if they don't feel like there's any role for them, then it's much easier to do nothing differently than you've ever done before than it is to do something differently. And if people lack that agency and think, oh, I cannot make a contribution because I'm one of however many billion people, and what does it matter what UK does or New Zealand does because China's going to unveil lots of coal-fired power stations? If you think that, then you end up doing nothing, even though you could have made a contribution, and maybe there's a way in which you can affect China and its coal-fired power stations. So it's not scaring the horses, and it's also giving people a role which can connect to change on the scale and pace that we want, even though, and this is the scary bit, it's change on the pace and scale which has been rarely achieved in the entirety of human history. I mean, when you try to think, well, historically, what examples are there, or if we take climate change in particular, what examples are there of a massive shift in our energy sources that happen on a global scale and happen quickly? It's not that many. The ones that would give me hope are, bizarrely, the shift from coal to oil, which was to a large extent driven by the dominant navy of the time, the Royal Navy, deciding to move from coal to oil, and that provided the infrastructure for others to ride off of. So it's possible. And the other one is the abolition of slavery. So if you think about slavery, there you had a more or less free, seemingly free resource, that the negative impacts were on people that the elites at the time didn't care about. So in our case, it's people in the future, people far away at that time, it was people who were slaves. It was entirely enmeshed in particular key sectors, apparel, cotton, and the people who ran those plantations said, if you change this, then the entire economy will fall apart. And yet, it was possible to make that transition. Now, it took Wilberforce and all of those people a generation, and it had to be started by the superpower of the time, imposing itself on the markets of the time. But still, it is possible to make those massive transitions. But it does require lots of different sorts of leadership, which we're not necessarily seeing at the moment.
And from your perspective, what was the business model for ending slavery?
Well, so there's an interesting thing, which is that there's some evidence that the plantation business model was becoming increasingly uncompetitive compared to the alternatives. It's one thing. that the relative costs were changing because of the Industrial Revolution and the availability of other sorts of energy. So you could replace people providing energy with steam. And so the transition was something to do with the elites on this sort of beginning to realise that there was an alternative which would still play out. The parallel there, which is the third example which can give us a bit of hope, is the transition to the welfare state. And Michael Jacobs, who's a former advisor to New Labour and is now a professor, I think, of Surrey, he has an interesting way of talking about transition to the welfare state in the 40s that happened here in the UK and the US and in much of the sort of what we now think of as the developed world. He said, well, there was four conditions which were had to be true. One was that you had had a massive crisis that meant that there was an opportunity for change. The second was that business elites could see that it was a viable path. The third was that somebody had laid the intellectual groundwork, and that's, in that case it's Keynes and demand management economics. And the fourth was that there was a popular movement who said, we, having had the experience of war and the experience of a war-planned economy, we are willing, we don't want this to happen again, we don't want the Great Depression to happen again, and therefore we're willing to go for a demand-managed economy. Those four things came together in a way which meant there was a transition. I think there's some of the same dynamics from the abolition of slavery to do with elite buy-in, enough of the right elite. There's enough of an intellectual case, there's enough of popular buy-in, partly because of tireless campaigning from Quakers going around lots of churches and making the case that people in slavery were people and therefore had souls in the eyes of God, these kinds of things, and more of a popular movement. So there's some different factors there, but the key thing is the window of opportunity, which is created by a sort of pressure from big trends and, if you like, the landscape which things are playing.
If we go through those,
yes,
popular movement.
Yeah,
how close are we? And are we close enough to some sort of tipping point of popularity?
Well, I think this is an area which would not give me a tremendous amount of hope. At the moment, we've had an attempt or a spasm, Occupy, I think what Occupy. So we had. So let's tell the story a slightly different way. We had a crisis, financial crisis, which seemed to disprove a lot of the intellectual foundations for what had been happening over the previous two decades. Of if you just leave companies alone in the market, they won't do anything so stupid as to harm themselves. Nobody would be that stupid. It turns out that bankers are that stupid, and other financial players, insurance companies and others. So there was a crisis, and there was the Occupy movement, which came as a spasm of, in my view, a spasm of sort of anger at the unfairness of, firstly, getting into the mess, and secondly, who was paying for the mess? It wasn't the bankers, it was the general populace. And they had a year's worth of causing trouble, but it seems to have dissipated massively. It's difficult to occupy New York when it's freezing cold, amongst other things.
But also, they are the 99%.
Mm.
Why didn't the 99% join them?
Well, and it was a lot of young people, wasn't it? And a lot of, I think, well, then you get into a lot of supposition. What's interesting is that in some ways, there's been a more effective a movement in places like Turkey and Brazil, where I think the story for Turkey and Brazil is more, where both of which have had rioting and a sort of civil unrest over the last 18 months. The story there is to do with, I think, and this is what the commentary I read says, people in the lower middle class who sort of moved up a level and in they can remember a time when they and their family were really struggling, and now they seem to be having a share in prosperity. They don't want that to be taken away from them, and they want more of a share in the decisions around which how that prosperity, increasing prosperity, is used. So in both of those cases, there are tiny trigger points, bus fares, and, you know, infrastructure for the World Cup, those trigger points are actually symbolic of we want more of a share in these decisions, and we don't want to for you to make decisions when we fall back into poverty. And the contrast with somewhere like London and New York is where at the point of Occupy, I don't think there's enough people who feared that they would downgrade their current and their children's future prosperity and say, oh, it's just those kids who can't wash their hair and we're going to ignore it. I think the interesting thing about austerity, now we're in year six, whatever it is to what extent are people giving up hope that the future was better than today? And at the moment, the way people are reacting to that in the UK and across Europe is they're turning to nationalistic parties. So here in the UK, it's UKIP, the UK Independence Party, which is saying all basically the problems are because of people over there, Europe, and because of immigrants coming into the UK. Never mind that an enormous proportion of new businesses are formed by immigrants, never mind that they work incredibly hard, never mind that they make a net contribution in tax. I mean, the facts do not back up this story, but nevertheless, this story speaks very much to people being afraid, feeling like globalization has taken control away from them and wanting to have more control, and that they're beginning to lose hope for the future, and they're turning nationalistically, they're turning inwardly to deal with it rather than turning outwardly. And I think it's interesting your podcast is called Resilience, because I think, or at least part of your framing is resilience, because one of the narratives which might give you more agency, which isn't just to protect your own kind of agency, is one to do with resilience. And to make ourselves more resilient, it's partly about distributing risk and ability to respond across many different nodes, if you like, so you're not as... But it's also to do with acknowledging interdependency, that what happens here or what happens way over there affects what happens here. So it's in our interest, it's in our enlightened self-interest over the medium term to make sure that things don't get really bad in Africa, because if things get really bad in Africa, then all of the people who live there will want to live somewhere else. And one of the places that wants to live somewhere else is here. And if you've got millions of Africans coming north into Europe, then we'll not be able to cope with that. It's much better to avoid the worst of climate change and avoid the worst of deforestation for our own resilience, speaking to my value set, I want those people who are in Africa, in the tropics around the world, which are most affected by climate change, to have the capability to choose how to live their own lives rather than be subjected and have to react to events well beyond their control. However, if we're going to speak to where most people are at, we have to find a way of framing in terms of that more slightly more inwardly facing circle of concern.
Let's tick off the rest of those then. Have we done, back to these four conditions, how are we going on the intellectual groundwork? Are we there with an understanding of where we're supposed to be going and how to get there?
I think, I have been part of the Policy Fellowship, which I mentioned earlier at Cambridge, involves interviewing folk. Cambridge academics mostly, about where do we want to get to and what's the transition together. And I think we know an awful lot about what the boundary conditions of a sustainable economy might be. So there's a lot about the environmental limits we have to be within. There's the Rockstrom paper, which people may know, which in Nature it had 9 boundary conditions. Other people have a slightly different list, but it's pretty, you've got climate change, you've got ocean acidification, you've got biodiversity, there's a list of stuff. And then when it comes to the social and political foundations, to speak to what I was saying before, give people the capability that they can make choices in their own lives. Again, that's moderately well known. You need a certain degree of equity, you need an understanding of interdependence, you need... access to energy, access to healthcare, water, sanitation, it's not. Those end goals and the boundaries, let's think of it as the table on which you could put your coffee cup, and your coffee cup is your sustainable economy. That's sort of well known. What people don't really have a good grasp of, or at least I can't find anyone who does, and if anyone listening does know, is how we make the transition from here to there, because there's a couple of things which make that really difficult. One is, it has to be economically viable at each step of the way. So that means that the current ways of making profit have to finance the things that drive us in a different direction. And we have to allocate capital, new finance, new investment, away from stuff that is familiar and is currently turning out profit, to choose a random example, oil and gas fields, shale gas, and put that into things which are a bridge into the new future. So we've got to reallocate all that capital. And interestingly, the divestment movement, which has been going very well in the US, and the divestment movement is one which has been campaigning at pension funds and trust funds, particularly university-owned ones, to say, if we're going to have a future worth living in, we can't be dragging all of this oil and gas out of the ground, therefore we need you to sell off oil and gas firms and invest that money in renewable forms of energy. What seems to be happening is that some of those funds are saying, we don't want to sell off on the oil and gas quite yet, but what we will do is we'll tell those firms to pay higher dividends. We'll take those dividends and invest them in new technologies and the path to renewable energy system. So if that happens, that's a sort of better than nothing. Not quite as good as taking money out of the oil and gas, but still better than nothing. So we are... We have problems to do with every step along the way has to be economically viable. The other problem is that every step along the way has to be politically viable. And so I had this fantastic conversation with a Cambridge academic who's a Nobel laureate. He's very clear on what the carbon price needs to be in order to represent the future externalities of climate change. Carbon price needs to be about $100 per ton. He spent his entire life investigating this. He's one of the top three people on this top domain. And so when I say to him, well, what's the path by which we get, politically, we get to have $100 a ton on all of our energy bills, all of our gas bills, all of our petrol bills? He says, well, I don't really know. I mean, once the first countries do it, probably developed countries, and they find that it gives them higher economic growth, then you'll have a domino effect where other countries will adopt it.
But it's politically...
But it's like, how do you get that first country? And to that, he had no answer. And I found that very strange in a way. Like, you've devoted your life to doing this, to getting a good price, or getting understanding of what the carbon price to be.
But not how to make it happen.
Not how to make it happen. And without knowing how to make it happen, it's another decimal point on the end of a universal constant. It doesn't make any difference. So, or at least... somebody else has to pick up that baton, and he doesn't even seem to be working with anyone else that they might pick up that baton. In terms of the intellectual case, I think what we're lacking at the moment is, how do we make the transition in a way that's economically and politically viable?
So the business elites to see the viable path, that's what we've been talking about for the last...
Well, I think we've been talking about the intellectual, the equivalent of Keynes. Where's the equivalent of Keynes? I don't think we've got that. Now, ironically, when it comes to more of the business elite in particular agreeing on the need for change, that's what we see amongst the businesses we work with at Forum. Now, we have to be a bit careful here, because Forum is a charity and we work at the leading edge, and we have a self-selecting sample of companies that we work with leaders. So it's not by any means enough companies. But having sat... we had a dinner for the chief executives of our pioneer partners last December, and that was people like Paul Pullman of Unilever, Ian Cheshire of Kingfisher, and others. For that cohort of chief executives, they understand that the long-term success of their businesses, the long-term interests of their shareholders, is tied up with creating a more sustainable world. I've seen the whites of their eyes, and I have complete... I believe that they believe that. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can get all 100,000, 150,000 people in your company to do anything about it, nor does it mean that you can escape the shackles of what your shareholders demand of you. So, like, even these powerful business people have constraints on their power, but the buy-in of a certain group group of the business elite is there. We need more and more to be brought in. But amongst the business people we speak with, it's no longer a question of why should we do the sustainability. It's now a question of how should we do it that is commercially viable given the rules of the
system.
Are
they passionate enough to be talking about it in the club and at the golf club?
Well, the two I just mentioned, Paul Pullman in Cheshire, certainly are passionate enough to be talking about it publicly. The irony of that being, the unfortunate thing about that being that they are all too lonely voices. I'm sure that they do talk about it in the different clubs they might go to. But we need, in a way, what we need now is unusual ambassadors. We need chief executives who you wouldn't expect to say that, because the message from those ones who've been saying it for a while is now being diminished because, he would say that, wouldn't he? And we need new and slightly unusual ambassadors.
Okay, last condition then is the massive crisis. I think that you and I agree that there's a massive crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But one other thing that always strikes me is that it would be really convenient if climate change was due to start next Tuesday.
Yes.
We had a thing that we could say. I've talked to other people who say that would be a bad thing because then we'd have to say, oh no, actually it's next week. Because it's sort of like never actually a thing happens, it would be worse. But I would like, it's very difficult for us to say, really, we need to do something about this now.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the difficulties might be very familiar to some of your listeners that humans, that we've evolved brilliantly to respond to things which are urgent, and we've evolved brilliantly to respond to things that you can see and touch and feel. Like, if you're a monkey in a tree, that's absolutely what you need to be good at. And if you're like, and what we have in the crisis, the slow, grinding, unfolding crisis that we have, are things that our actions today affect the world in 25 plus years. And the climate change we'll be experiencing over the next 10, 15, 20 years was set in train by a cumulative past behaviour up until about whatever it is, 1985, 1990. So we are, so our evolutionary heritage and our political institutions are really badly set up to deal with climate change. And in many ways, that's why there is a crisis. It's because it's in the gaps between how we do things. That's, if we could deal with it, we'd have dealt with it, but we can't deal with it, and therefore it's ongoing. What would be fantastic in a way, because of the long term effect, would be to have some in this I'm following one of our founders, Jonathan, an article he wrote for Green Futures, one of our magazines a couple of years ago, which is, it would be fantastic to have a hurricane which wipes out Florida or Miami, but with enough notice that everyone can get out. So it's not a lethal thing, but it just damages so much property in an expensive property, much insured property area, that that it would really make the consequences of climate change a clear and present danger to the largest and most powerful economy and political.
And because that would challenge systems, we know that in insurance systems around the world have been challenged just by the fact that the Christchurch earthquake and the Japanese earthquake happened at pretty much the same time.
Yeah,
that whole protection system was really challenged by that. So you're right, a big challenge like that would get noticed.
And to some extent, we nearly had that with Hurricane Sandy, which really affected New York. And I'm told that the conversation in New York is completely different now. Reduce the suffering that comes from inaction in the medium and long term, we need a little bit of suffering now. It's a really, it's so depressing in a way, it's so difficult to say that, because it would be much better to say rational argument will carry the day, but rational argument hasn't carried the day. So we need something which will loosen people's ties to the status quo. Now, in some ways you could say that we've already missed one window of opportunity, which was the financial crisis, which if we'd had a stronger, better developed intellectual case, then an intellectual alternative, like the equivalent of Keynes, then maybe we would have been able to use that financial crisis to replace laissez-faire markets with something else and replace our dependence on financing for financing's sake and actually make the finance sector something which helps the rest of the economy rather than feeds off the rest of the economy. Unfortunately, that window we missed. So we're back to the long, slow grind, hoping that it will give rise to another window of opportunity. Now, this is where the resilience framing comes in, because if we can lay... So I'm not... So one of the things which is coming out of the policy fellowship thinking and work is that it does seem to me we need a political narrative which people from across the political spectrum can buy into, and that gives people agency and causes action quickly. Now, the resilience narrative could potentially do that. That might be a positive thing, in that there's something you can do. It's about preparing for the crises which are going to happen. You can bring people into that, and then when a crisis does happen, then you take massive advantage of that window of opportunity. And then it's a question of trying to think through what crises might there be. One around food provision. There's droughts, lots of different bread baskets around the world, Ukraine. But that also has other problems, non-trivial ones as well, but Australia, California. So you can imagine there's some sort of food price crisis, which is eminently feasible to imagine. How can we prepare ourselves? So firstly, the damage of that is reduced. And secondly, that we can take advantage of that crisis to shift the global food system. So a resilience narrative can give people agency, it gives them stuff to do in their locale, it gives them a way of thinking more into the future. The thing I don't like about it, its sort of shadow side, is that it accepts that some sort of crisis is going to happen, that we can't really avoid some sort of downside in order to create action. And there's still the utopian optimist part of me which would say, well, with enough, you know,
I don't know,
with enough workshops, with enough podcasts, we'll be able to get people to act before we are in that situation. But I suspect that was probably 5 or 10 years ago. So there's something appealing as well as appalling about the resilience narrative, which could bind people together to act.
Okay, some questions to end with.
Mm-hmm.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, so social justice. So social justice and creating change. For social justice, so I get really annoyed. I get annoyed when there's persistent injustice, and in particular where there's nothing that the people at the end of that can do anything about it. Now, we're in a very complicated moment in history where fairness has always meant different kinds of things. Fairness of outcome, fairness of opportunity, fairness of process, things like that. And there's some mixture for me of fairness of outcome and fairness of opportunity. We just have to acknowledge that we're not set up for that at the moment. And so this for me makes what people think of as environmental issues are really social issues, because what we're going to be doing, if we take climate change as our example, it's been caused by the emissions by rich countries. It's going to affect poor countries. And it's going to reduce, it's going to take away the choices and the ability to have the life that people want to lead in the tropics in the first instance. And that's not remotely their fault, but the costs are going to be imposed on them. That's a social justice question. It's the environment is the means, but the real reason why I'm motivated about it is social justice. So what gets me out of bed in the morning is creating change to avoid those injustices.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I guess to the... No. For me, activist is someone whose primary way of trying to create change is protesting outside of the castle walls. I guess I'd say that the role I can play, I think, and this is one of the reasons why I'm at the forum, is that we need the activists at the gate banging and causing elites to understand that there's a need for change, And I think my role is being the advisor inside the court who helps the barons do something about it. You need both parts of that movement. You need the activists and you need the ones who help those help people who have resources and power to do something. And that doing something might include getting out of the way of the disruptive elements. So it's not just about current winners remain winners, but I think of my role as much more inside the gates and therefore not an activist. We know that Forum is not well liked amongst some activists. I'm sure that for many of my friends from Oxford, former friends from Oxford, who are now bankers and lawyers and so on, they think of me as an activist, but that's not where I place myself.
What challenges do you have for the next couple of years?
Well, I think that the key challenge is to do with how can we take advantage of the windows of opportunity that come along to avoid the worst and get the best in that in terms of the transition to a sustainable economy. I think taking advantage of those windows of opportunity is partly to do with mainstream players, existing status quo players. It's partly to do with how can you stir the pot of disruptors and entrepreneurs and people outside of the mainstream so that they can take advantage. But that's, I think, the main challenge.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur when you wake up tomorrow morning, what would it be?
A plausible miracle or a completely... So, I don't really believe in miracles, but I think it would be that... the smallest thing that might make the biggest difference.
Yeah.
Let's think about it that way. I mean, this is still not a small thing, but if the most important decision makers in politics, civil service, business, civil society, if all of them woke up tomorrow thinking on a 10 or 15 year time horizon, which would be 10 to 15 times longer than their current planning horizons in many cases, if they were to think on that time horizon, then I think that would cascade into... So if you have a 10 to 15 year time horizon, then you have an enlightened self-interest on not just your entity, the thing you're responsible for, but all the things that entity relies on and all the things that entity impacts on. And I think once you have that time horizon, then you need to start thinking in terms of, well, who else shares with me those goals about creating a good context for my entity? And then you get into collaborations and coalitions, and then you can harness much larger resources than you have in your individual entity to create a world in which there's the public goods that are required for the private benefit. So I think having a longer term time horizon is the smallest change, but then you need an enormous number of people to have that change.
So you might have just answered this, but you might have a different answer.
Right.
Do you have any advice for listeners?
My advice for your listeners. So I think one thing is that there is always something you can do wherever you are. So we spoke a little bit earlier about agency. It's easy to feel like these challenges are so enormous, there's nothing that anyone can do in any situation. And I suppose Forum's approach and my personal approach, we've talked about elites and business leaders, and it's all easy to focus on what they over there should be doing. Well, they should, but also there's things that everyone else can be doing. You can be doing, you're as a consumer, as a voter, what you buy, who you vote for, how you interact with your local community. So I'll give you an example. My osteopath, I learned last time I was having my bones cracked. of joint grant. She volunteers with a local youth club. So, I mean, that's a nice thing. And then the other thing I learned is that she's putting a couple of £1,000 of her own money and her husband's money into a new cafe in which the people from the youth club who can't find jobs can have jobs. These are people who can't read and write, and so they're having to come up with displays on their tills which don't have words but instead have pictures. And she asked, well, how come you're putting in so much of your own money? It's more than, to be honest, it's more than I would do. And she said, well, I just can't complain about this anymore. I complained about people from my youth club not being able to find jobs. Well, there's something I can do about it. So that I found very inspiring. Obviously, that's a big thing. But there's little things, and if everyone does lots of little things, they do add up. Companies do listen to what people put on. If enough people say the same sort of thing, either through their purchasing habits or through their voting or through other channels, then it will make a difference. And so that's my key advice, is there's something you can do wherever you are.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Today's sustainable lens was that of David Bent, the Director of Sustainable Business at Forum for the Future and Policy Fellow at Cambridge University. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook and various other places, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.